Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, The People versus the Masters of Mankind. Three short talks by Noam Chomsky. I hope you'll stay tuned. Noam Chomsky is a brilliant analyst of U.S. foreign and domestic policies and current affairs. He's also a very good rhetorician. Properly speaking, a rhetorician is not the guy making the speech. A rhetorician is the guy who analyzes the speech, who explores the persuasive strategies, the propaganda. The guy making the speech is not the rhetorician, but the rhetor. Now you know. Whatever. Actually, Chomsky is very good at both. He's brilliant. He's articulate. He has many millions of fans worldwide. And you will never see or hear him in the U.S. corporate-controlled media. That includes the corporate-controlled alleged public television and alleged public radio. You will never see or hear him because he very effectively criticizes the established system of power. The purpose of U.S. mass media is to celebrate and increase and perpetuate established power, not to undercut it. So don't look for Chomsky there, but you can find him here. Here's a chat by Chomsky that's not very well known. He spoke in Syracuse, New York, in November 2011. We'll hear a question and answer session that followed his hour-long speech. Chomsky does not give answers. He gives impromptu 10-minute mini-lectures. I find them fascinating, and they make for great radio. A common theme here is that the American people are a very decent, moral bunch who do care for justice and care for the community. But they have almost no power to shape politics and society. All the shots are being called by a tiny elite that Adam Smith sarcastically called the Masters of Mankind. Chomsky likes that phrase. The political system our masters have created is not democracy, and the economic system they've created is not capitalism. The economic system works very well, but only for them. The good news is that the American people are basically good, and some change is probable, indeed likely. That optimism comes later in our broadcast. Chomsky's first mini-lecture is on how the masters are deliberately destroying public education in America, and why. Here is Noam Chomsky.
Well, that's a really important issue. The public education system was one of the real major achievements of this country. It was the first country to have a really broad mass education system. That contributed enormously not only to the cultural health of the country but to its economic growth. That after the Second World War, there was the major period of economic growth in U.S. history was the several decades after the Second World War. And a substantial reason for that was the GI Bill, which allowed a huge number of people, not enough unfortunately, but a huge number of people to go to college who would never have been able to do it. And in those days, college was cheap. Public education was free. I mean, I went to college in 1945, and I happened to go to the local, I went to the local school, you know, you never went anywhere else, but the local school happened to be the University of Pennsylvania, which is private, but it was $100, you know, and you could get it, and you could easily get a scholarship. So education was basically free, and for the GI Bill, it's a huge number of people, and that had an enormous impact. Well, all of that's being reversed. There's an attack on public education which is without any precedent. It goes all the way from kindergarten up to the universities. So take, say, the universities. I'll just tell you a personal experience. A couple of months ago, I travel around a lot giving talks. I happened to give a talk in Mexico City, at the National University. A pretty impressive university, a couple hundred thousand students, very high level, very engaged. I mean, salaries are ridiculously low by our standards, but they work. The facilities are pretty good. It's free. That's a poor country, you know? But public education is free. Furthermore, in Mexico City itself, there's a city-run college, which is not only free, but has open admissions. So anybody can go, and if they need help to get in, they get remedial training. I was there too, pretty impressive, also high standards. Well, that's a poor country. I happened to go from there to the Bay Area in California. It's maybe the richest place in the world outside of the Gulf Emirates. The public education system is being systematically destroyed. Tuition is so high in the major universities that it's just for the rich. In fact, it's at the level of Ivy League colleges. For this year, for the first time, more funding for the public institutions is coming from tuition than from the state, in a rich state, not Mexico. And this is happening all over the country. I mean, in a majority of the states by now, the tuition in the public universities is higher than funding. Now, it's not because of the lack of wealth, and it's not because of the deficit, which is complete farce, as is easily to show. It's because of the decision to destroy public education. In California, for example, the great universities, which are being, will be almost certainly be privatized. They're almost private now. You know, very high tuitions, big endowments, and so on. And that means the rest of the system, it gets kind of lowered to low-level technical training. Well, you know, for the economy, forget the human cost. For the economy of California, that's very serious. California became rich in large measure because of the high-level education system. Well, the people who are running the program, that top one-tenth of 1% of the population, they don't care. I mean, their kids will be fine. You know, they don't use the public education system. It's privatized, they can pay for it, they have phenomenal wealth. And there's a change, and this generalizes over the country, we have to recognize a significant change in the nature of contemporary state capitalism from the 70s. You go back to the 1950s, the CEO of a firm, say General Motors, had to care about the future of the firm. They had to have brand loyalty, you know, the firm had to persist and so on. So they tried to build it so it would persist. That's not true anymore. The CEO of, say, General Electric, which is mostly a financial institution, all they have to do is make money in the short term. I mean, and then, of course, they get bailed out by the taxpayer if anything goes wrong. But if the company itself declines, it doesn't matter. They walk away with their golden parachute. That's the new system. And as for the country, they don't really care about it. Along with the financialization of the economy came offshoring of production. So if you can make more profit by using super cheap exploited labor in China, let's say, without environmental constraints and so on, fine. It happens to harm this country severely, but that's not their concern. So we're getting into a situation where the future of the country just doesn't matter for the people, for the decision makers. And it's going all the way down to elementary school. I don't have to tell you, there's a huge attack on teachers. I mean, an effort to try to shift the blame for the financial crisis and a general economic crisis away from, you know, Goldman Sachs to the public school teachers and the firefighters with their huge pensions. I mean, they're so ludicrous you can hardly believe that they're getting away with it. And there is a backlash, like in Wisconsin, a significant backlash, but it's certainly going on. And it is, so you're right, there's a major effort to destroy the public school system. Now, I think there's a fundamental reason behind that, It's not just that the rich don't care. I think the same thing lies behind the attack on Social Security. Social Security is a phenomenally successful program, has almost no administrative costs. I mean, far less than privatized insurance and so on. Very cheap, works very well, keeps a lot of people alive. It doesn't mean much to people in higher income levels. You know, they get a small amount, they can forget it. But for a lot of the population, that's what keeps them surviving, particularly after the huge economic collapse, the collapse of the real estate bubble. So why attack Social Security? Well, partly it's of no benefit to the rich, but there's a deeper reason, I think, and I think it's the same reason as the public education system. I can't prove it, but this is what it looks like to me. The public education system and Social Security are based on a certain principle, namely the principle that we care about other people. Okay. And that's... So, yeah. Social Security means you care that a disabled widow across town doesn't have food to eat. Or let's say I don't have kids in school, but you know, I'm happy to pay school taxes because I care that the kid across the street can go to school. And this concept of sympathy and social solidarity is considered extremely dangerous. There's a major effort, propaganda effort, to try to drive into people's heads that you should only be concerned for yourself. Now, there's nothing new about this. You go back in America, it's good to learn, know about American history. You go back to, say, 1850, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, and incidentally, the period of the freest press in the United States. There were hundreds, thousands of newspapers with a lot of readership, the direct participation. They were written, you know, factory workers and others. And one of the main themes was anger at what was called the new spirit of the age. Gain wealth, forgetting all but self. That was the new spirit of the age in 1850. And there's been a tremendous effort over the years to somehow drive that into people's heads and drive out all normal human feelings. And, you know, it's had some success. And I think you see it in the willingness of parts of the population, at least, to try to kill the elements of the society and the culture that are based on care and concern for other people, and to try to turn people into crazed maniacs who care about nothing but themselves. Well, that's pretty dangerous. Again, if it was happening in some small country, you know, it'd be a shame. But when it's happening in the richest, most powerful country in history, it's very dangerous.
Somebody asks, what should be done to make the system better? Or is this even possible?
Well, sure, we know it's, I think, you know, it's an important point, and we know that it's possible because it's been done over and over again. I mean, that's why we don't live under feudalism, we don't have slavery, women have some rights. I mean, yes, it's because of things like that. I mean, and it's a lot of it's in very, you know, our own recent lifetimes. It's a lot, the society is a lot more civilized than it was, say, 50 years ago, in a lot of respects. There have been repeated periods through American history when there's been a struggle, a popular struggle, against the effort to turn human beings into, you know, satanic creatures. And it succeeded over and over. Like, take, say, financial crisis, okay, the immediate cause of the current economic crisis. There weren't any financial crises from the Second World War up until Reagan. None. And the reason is there was a regulatory apparatus in place. There was a regulatory apparatus which comes out of the New Deal. And the New Deal wasn't a gift from above. It came from very extensive popular struggle. CIO organizing, you know, sit-down strikes, mass demonstrations, all sorts of things. I mean, that's my childhood, I remember. And that left a legacy which, first of all, meant like the GI Bill, like substantial economic growth, egalitarian growth in the 50s and the 60s, not like what's happened since. and things like, say, a regulatory apparatus which can tame the worst excesses of the system. The deficiencies are still there, but there are ways of remedying them. Same with healthcare. Like now, there's a battle to try to save Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor. But if you go back 50 years, there was nothing to save. They came because of the activism of the 1960s, which got the government to do some, not as much as they should, but at least something. Now, take a look, say, at the famous deficit. For the financial institutions, they want everybody to focus on the deficit. You get rid of the deficit, it's good for bankers. It's not the problem of the country. The problem of the country is joblessness. And that requires stimulus, not deficit, not austerity. But let's even put that aside. Suppose we buy into the propaganda and say, okay, we're worried about the deficit. Where's it come from? Well, about half the deficit is military spending. You know, the U.S. You all know this. The U.S. spends about as much as the rest of the world combined. It's not for security. As I mentioned, it's harming security. It has other purposes, like the ones that Clinton mentioned. So that's half the deficit. And where's the other half? The other half comes from the completely dysfunctional healthcare system. It's a privatized, unregulated healthcare system. It's an international scandal, has twice the per capita costs or more of comparable countries, some of the worst outcomes, a huge number of people with no coverage at all. Well, you know, it's not, if our healthcare system was the same as other industrial countries, there would not only not be a deficit, there would be a surplus. Okay? Now, it's not utopian to think that we can radically cut a military system that's dangerous for the world and harmful to us, and it's certainly not utopian to think that we can have a healthcare system like other countries. Now, that's not utopian. But those things aren't discussed. And they're not discussed because of the control of doctrine and debate and discussion by the same narrow concentration of power setting these policies. Well, you know, you take a look at people's attitudes, it's very striking. It's a heavily polled country. We know a lot about what people think. And it's worth looking. So, for example, there are recent studies of that sector of the population that says, get the government off our backs. Let's have a small government. That kind of sentiment. You take a look at what their attitudes are. It turns out they're social democrats. Literally, they think there should be more money spent on education, on health, on more money should be used for helping poor people like women with dependent children, but not welfare. Not welfare, but all the things that welfare does. And the reason is because welfare has been demonized. Ever since Reagan, welfare means black women, being chauffeured to the welfare station by their chauffeured Cadillacs and picking up your money. Well, okay, nobody wants that. So let's get rid of welfare, but let's keep, or in fact increase, all the things that welfare does. And one of the most striking cases is foreign aid. A huge number of people opposed to foreign aid, way too high. When they're asked what they think foreign aid is, they give estimates, way beyond the miserly level that it is. When they're asked what they think it ought to be, twice as high as it is. Well, this generalizes. The people are resistant to these efforts to turn them into monsters. But if you're sitting alone, listening to Fox News, and you're not getting anything else from the Democrats either, NPR, you get muddled, confused, and that's what groups like this are about, to try to carry out the policies of the programs of organization that will enable people to break out of this. Now, that's... I've purposely been keeping to band-aids, to very small things that could be done to make it a much better society. But I think your question pointed to something deeper. What about the institutions themselves? They're not graven in stone. They can be changed. You don't have to have institutions like that, and there's plenty of possibilities, but that's another question.
Someone notes that a hedge fund billionaire has just been indicted for financial crimes. Is this a good sign? Is the government at long last cracking down on Wall Street's crimes?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a case that's been going on for a while. And he's not being indicted for things like the lying and the cheating and the dishonesty that created the financial and economic crisis. He's being tried for things that harmed other businesses. And they don't like it, you know. So they'll go after people who harm their interests. I didn't read the report, but if it happened, yeah, it's, that's...
Even in the enforcement, if it's around businesses...
It's enforcement, but nothing very... I mean, the serious enforcement ought to be the kind of things that Borowski's talking about, the special inspector for the bailout. I mean, there was, to repeat what he said, it's important, there was a bargain. The bargain is the culprits who created the disaster will be bailed out by the taxpayer, and the people who were harmed by them will get at least, you know, something. You know, maybe they'll be able to stay in their homes instead of being thrown out. Well, as he pointed out, half that bargain was kept. The other half was disregarded. It tells us something about how democracy functions. The loud voices, the rich loud voices, yeah, they get their way. Adam Smith's Masters of Mankind. The rest of the population are, you know, it's the Marger Doctrine again. We can disregard them so they'll get thrown out of their homes. All right, that's a major crime, as is the fact that there is a, that credit rating agencies are now calculate, when they give a credit rating to some company, they count in the likelihood, in fact, near certainty, that if they go bust, the taxpayer will bail them out. That makes them a lot more rich and powerful than they were. All right, those are real fundamental forms of corruption. I don't know if you call it corruption. The same is true of, say, tax policy. I mean, if you take a look at tax policy, it's pretty amazing. So take, say, the Bush tax cuts, which are a tremendous burden on the economy. I mean, if it wasn't for the effect of those tax cuts, we'd have nothing like the crisis that there is now. Well, how were the tax cuts designed? Take a look at it. Those of you who are old enough may remember, the tax cuts were 2001. They were going to run for 10 years. The first year, everybody got a couple $100 in the mail. So, I'm giving you a tax cut for everybody. And it was tilted toward the wealthy, but it was everybody got something. But it was designed so that year after year, that would shift. And in the last year, I think it was the top 1% got over half the tax cuts. But by then, everyone had forgotten, you know. That's called a sunset policy. You design programs so at first they don't look too bad, and then as they begin to take effect, they go to what the masters want. All for ourselves and nothing for anyone else, what Adam Smith called the vile maxim of the masters of mankind. That's the way policy is designed. You go to the congressional debate now, so take John Boehner yesterday. Everything's on the table except the Bush tax cuts, okay? We've got to make sure that the rich get even richer and more powerful. Now, there's a way of talking about this, and if you read his speech, it's typical. He said, we have to do this because of jobs. You think for a moment, it has nothing to do with jobs. You want jobs, that's not what you do. But we have to remember that there's been an interesting change in the English language. There's a certain word which you're not allowed to pronounce. It's an obscene word. Since there are children in the audience, I'll spell it instead of pronouncing it. P-R-O-F-I-T-S. You're not allowed to use that word. That word is now pronounced jobs. Okay, so when you read about a... these are... And here the media just go along, and commentary just goes along, and so on. Those are real serious problems. Or take, say, the debate over Medicare. It's the Ryan proposal, which is supposed to be serious and courageous. We're supposed to think about it. It's designed on the sunset policy. Take a look at it. It's designed to destroy Medicare, but not for the current voting population. So people who are 55 or over, which is a big part of the voting population, they're excluded. Okay, so their Medicare will stay. What's going to be killed is years down the road. And that's not a small effect. Congressional Budget Office estimates a $34 trillion cost to seniors over the life of the program. $34 trillion. All right, that's what's being cut for elderly people, but not now, because we want them to vote for it now, so they're exempt. Sunset policy again. Medicaid is being devastated. And what is being omitted is the source of the problem. Medicare is not a problem. Medicare is pretty efficient, has quite low administrative costs, it works pretty well. It's very expensive, but the reason is it works through the privatized system. That's where the costs are, the ridiculous costs, you know, profits, advertising, bureaucracy, all kind of things. That's why it's twice as high as anywhere else. Well, that's not being touched. Okay, so all of these debates are framed in a way which kind of guarantee that the rich and powerful will get more rich and more powerful and the rest will suffer. All right, those are real problems, but they can be dealt with. You know, it doesn't have to be like that.
Thank you. Noam Chomsky, concluding three nice mini-lectures after his main lecture in Syracuse, New York, November 11, 2011. That was from a video recording made by Wilton Vaught for his local public access cable TV show, now, alas, defunct. You can find an archive of Vaught's stuff at his website, othervoicesotherchoices.blogspot.com. And I'll put a link to that on our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum. Please tune in again next week, and remember, the society the Masters of Mankind has built is not healthy for children and other living things, including our own Mother Earth. Ciao.